Chris Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nimmers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Hello and welcome to this week's Nailers Natter, and this week I'm incredibly excited to welcome another podcaster to our ever-growing Nailers Natter team. This week we welcome Joe Dukes, who is the Trust Curriculum Research Lead at the Education Alliance Teal Trust and Wald Associate Research School. Joe has excellent credentials in the world of evidence, research and CPD, and I'm sure that you're as excited as I am to hear who Joe lines up to interview. So Joe's debut interview is someone I've been chasing for quite a while, a titan of the science world and a legend of CPD, Nimish Ladd. And this interview takes in some of my favourite themes that we have to discuss on Nailers Natter. So Joe and Nimish discuss CPD, science, evidence-based teaching and action research. In the podcast pedagogy section, I am looking at Some Kids I Taught and What They Taught Me by Kate Clancy. And I may also sneak a review in for this week's music listen, which is Station to Station by David Bowie. Just to finish off, can I thank you all for your support, continuing to listen in your hundreds despite little or no publicity recently from me. Hopefully this is what attracted you to the podcast in the first place, the fact that we are all teachers in schools, and recently my role, and I'm sure your role the same, but my role as deputy head in school has become rather all-consuming with bubbles, models and September preparations abounding, so we appreciate every single one of you being there and listening. So as you always say, without further ado, here is my new team member, Joe Dukes, interviewing Nimish Ladd.
Today on Nailers Natter, I'm chatting to Nimish Ladd. Nimish is Vice Principal for Curriculum and Assessment at Wren School in Northamptonshire. Nim and I originally bonded over a joint love of the four C's: CPD, curriculum, Christmas, and calories. And today we're going to be looking at CPD. I was lucky enough to hear Nim speak about curriculum on a panel at Research Edinburgh back at the beginning of March, when research eds were a thing that you went to, not logged on to. The good old days. We've been meaning to have a good old chat about CPD for a while now, but our conversations are nearly always taken over by talk of music and food. So it's good that we've been able to carve out some time to really focus on CPD. I've been particularly interested in talking to Nim about the action research model that is used at Wren School, as it bears some similarities with that of the CPD models that I have been lucky enough to be part of implementing, both at my current trust and at my former school. Hello, Nim.
Hi, Joe. It's lovely to finally talk shop with you after us always, like you say, talking things that are never shop, to be honest. So it's great to be here.
So shall we start by telling listeners a bit about yourself and how you became a teacher and how you got into the role that you're currently in?
Yeah, that's fine. So the area I'm in, Wellingborough, is where I grew up as a child. I went to Wren School, the school that I'm currently at. And after leaving there, I had four amazing years in London at UCL studying physics. And I really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I had like a whole bunch of different jobs while I was there. I was an usher at We Will Rock You, which was amazing. I managed to do some stewarding and hospitality at football events and cricket stadia. I did a few podcasts, not anything like this, of course, nothing with this standing. But I did a few podcasts while I was there and wrote for some magazines and interestingly did some wedding photography. And I stumbled into teaching through doing outreach with the university, going to some of the schools in North London. And I really got a bit of a buzz for working with students in the classroom and helping them understand things that they couldn't understand before. So I went down to do my PGCE down at St Mary's in Twickenham, so that's in Richmond in South London, and it was absolutely amazing. It was brilliant. I got to see the England rugby team there all the time. It was great to meet them so often around there, just after they'd won the World Cup, so that was amazing. And I trained in two completely different schools while I was there. One, which was in Walworth, which is in central London, so a really sort of hard inner city school. Lots of deprivation, lot high pupil premium, and a really sort of tough school to start off with. And then I luckily got to spend the second part of my training with an outstanding mentor called Wendy Butler in Barnet. And I really got to start to understand the importance of research and education and looking at pedagogy in detail. So I got the full range of spectrum on my PGC, which is phenomenal. And I was so lucky to have that. After that, so this was back in 2006, I decided to move back to Wellingborough, almost to give a bit back to the town that made me the person that I was. So I moved back. I got a job at Wren, the school I was at as a pupil, and I spent 5 years there. There were loads of staff there that taught me while I was a student there, still there teaching, and I was then teaching alongside them as a colleague. But the school was so different. It's completely different when you're a student at a school and then being a teacher at the school. You see the full range of spectrum of classes and of students. When you're in a class yourself as a student, you only see what you see day in, day out. And it was really weird seeing things from that point of view. They say don't meet your heroes, and it was a bit like that, pretty much. And one of the things that I'd noticed while I was there was that the school was stuck, pretty much. It was one of these typical stuck schools before stuck schools became a thing. And it was in Notice to Improve, the old Notice, it's really showing my age now, Notice to Improve, that bit between satisfactory and special measures. Ofsted were in and out all the time. So during my NQT year, I think I met Ofsted 3 or 4 times, that they were coming in to support us, to try to move us on. So I really learned a lot about action planning and how to write a good action plan. And I saw a lot of that modelling taking place in the school from the leaders above me. So within 2 or 3 years, I managed to pick up a small TLR there for CPD. And it was more of a coordination of CPD, rather than actually any real strategic leadership of it, but looking more at coordinating sort of small events within the school. And this sort of became a moment for me where I realized that actually to make a real difference in terms of school improvement, CPD is the key for it. I then decided to sort of move on to a school nearby as head of science. It was still within the same town, and spent 2 years there, again, where I started to put CPD at the heart of what I was doing as a head of science to really transform what was happening in the department and move outcomes forward. I then moved down to Bedford to a school called Wootton Upper School, where I was an assistant principal there for a couple of years, helped to set up one of the free schools that have set up over there as a sixth form college. And was involved in creating teach meets and really looking into research informed practice and applying CPD across the whole school, not just within a department. But one of the things I picked up at that point was none of the schools that I was at really had any sort of CPD lead that sat on SLT. And that was, or someone who was in charge of staff development purely that sat on SLT. And that was a real moment for me. It really made me think that actually that is such an important thing within a school. It was about that time, so this was 2015 it was about, that I became a dad. Oh, that's great, I forgot the date that I became a dad, and my wife's gonna kill me when she hears this. I became a dad in 2015, and I thought I'd return to Wren, just as a teacher of science and looking really at research-informed practice and how we can use that to make a difference across the school. But very quickly, there was a need for me to become the head of science there. But there was a new head in place from compared to my previous time at Wren. And he had a really clear mantra of what he was trying to instill, and that was growth from within. And he really wanted to grow the school from the staff that were there, that were Wren and that knew Wren, and wanted to use them to drive the school forward, because it wasn't in the best place still. So I was head of science within a year. And then at the end of the first year, I was promoted to leadership team there to look at data and assessment. So new head, new motivation, growth from within, and a whole new SLT. So 2 months into our stint as SLT, we get slammed with an Ofsted grade 4. Fantastic. So none of the results were related to us as SLT, because pretty much all but one or two of them were brand new. I mean, it completely ripped us to shreds. It took us a bit of time to get over it. It was a really powerful moment in my career. It was probably the lowest moment in my career, getting that 4. Every single member of leadership team there was really attached to that school in some way. And we really felt that Ofsted grade 4 personally, not just professionally. It was a real moment in a negative sense, but again, one of the most important moments in my career. It helped me understand what needed to be done to move schools forward. And they gave us a really clear direction in which we needed to go. So we ripped apart data and reporting, ripped apart assessment, ripped apart teaching and learning, quality assurance, but CPD was the key. And it was something that I kept banging on about while I was there, and how actually CPD is what's going to drive the school improvement. So within 18 months, we got to an officer grade two with improved outcomes. We were rebrokered to a new trust. All of this while it was happening, while we were moving from this officer grade four to a two, we were in and out of schools week, I think every other week, regarding something with the trust that was happening. We were threatened with closure at times, you know, 1.3 million in debt, loads of stuff. So it was a real baptism of fire for us as a leadership team, but the best development work I've ever done in my life. I learned so much at a time. It was absolutely amazing, and I wouldn't have it any other way. A new trust came in. They gave us a fresh approach. They looked at the school. They gave us carte blanche to continue the work that we were doing. I got promoted to vice principal and into the role that I'm in now, looking at curriculum, assessment, timetable and cover. And I started to do a lot more outreach work at that point. I got to meet the wonderful Carly Waterman and Tom Rees at Educating Northampton. First time I met Kat Howard as well over there. It was an absolutely amazing event. And that got me on the whole research circuit. Managed to get onto Research Ed London, where I'm still absolutely mad at myself that I didn't come to see yourself, Louise, and Joe, do your CPD talk, because I heard it was amazing. Everyone kept telling me how amazing it was. So I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about that today. And then I did Research Ed Northampton and Research Ed Birmingham as well, as you mentioned. So yeah, it's been a journey of 14, 15 years, but a great one.
Yeah, I think it's interesting what you're saying about your first kind of journey into CPD was a PLR. For so long, CPD was kind of seen as this add-on TLR post rather than an integral strategic part of a school, which is crazy considering the impact that the quality of teaching has on student outcomes. So,
yeah, yeah. I completely agree. And one of the things that we discussed quite heavily at REN is CPD at the top table. You know, it's almost on every SOT agenda that we talk about, you know, what are our development needs, and what we try and avoid is that fad culture of like, oh, something new's come along, let's just chuck that at it and see what happens. But actually develop themes that run throughout a year that are linked to our development plans, that are linked to what we know our staff are interested in, what we know will make a difference to our outcomes, and more than anything, we'll just improve teaching and learning by either improving workload or improving the quality of output from teachers. And you're right in the sense that for a long time, it was just seen as a job of a TLR somewhere, rather than actually someone who sits right at the top of the school and actually can direct this in a real way and set the tone.
It's one of the things that Joe and Lou and I talk about in our research ed session when we kind of go through the CPD program that we developed, was the amount of sessions that we were subject to, and I use that term intentionally, that we were subject to, where somebody would be brought in and they'd tell us to do something and you'd kind of magpie it and you'd take it to your classroom, you'd use it a few times and then you'd forget about it, because in the meantime you'd get another session that you were kind of forced to go in because it was part of your directed time. And it's so good to see so many schools now moving away from that and moving towards this kind of what you were just talking about, that long-term thread of focus. Actually, that leads me quite nicely into my next question. So I'm really, really interested in the action research model that you've created. Can you tell me about what it was? You kind of touched upon this. What was there before? What led to it being implemented as it was?
Yeah, I've touched on sort of like the position where we were in, which was on Ofsted grade four, and staff really just being really down about not themselves but the school. But when staff are at a school that's a four, quite often they take it on themselves that it's because of them they're there, and we were really wary of that as a leadership team. We didn't want the staff to feel that, you know, oh, they're an Ofsted grade four, that the school's an Ofsted grade four. And it was a real careful sequence of events that we needed to look at there to make sure that whatever happened, we didn't damage the self-efficacy of staff. We didn't want them to feel any worse about themselves or that they could make the difference to get us to that next step. So that was where we were really at the time. We had a very I guess I'd say the word vulnerable, a really vulnerable staff body, that, and it could have gone either way at that point. You know, there were tears when we made the announcement of the fall. We had to tread very carefully, plan our words, plan our speeches, and plan our talk to the school, to our staff. It was almost like we're like wartime leadership, almost like, you know, our backs are against the wall. But when people's backs are against the wall, you see their true character. And I think that's what really helped us at this point, that we came together as a school, as a family, and move forward. And we really hung things on a couple of key bits that helped us move forward. We made it really clear that the only way we were going to move forward from where we were is if we improve teaching and learning within school. And the way we're going to improve teaching and learning in the school was by empowering teachers. Nobody, and I maintain this to this day, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, "Do you know what? I'm just going to do a bad job today." Nobody says that. I'll be flabbergasted if I find someone who actually thinks in that way. So if people are not doing the job that we want them to do, then how are we supporting them? How are we helping them? How are we empowering them? And that was one of the big conversations that we had as a leadership team, to think, how are we actually going to move forward? And I know I'm talking quite often about, oh, the leadership team did this, the leadership team did that. We have someone who looks after staff development in the school, but actually all of us as a team, it was our job to make it the number one priority. Although there is someone whose title is assistant principal for staff development and essentially has the school improvement plan and CPD, and essentially the quality of teaching of staff under his remit, it's all of our job as SLT to support that. He sets a tone, he sets a direction, we buy into it, we all work together with it, and then we all drive the school forward from that point. There was also this whole national picture at the time about performance-related pay and performance management, and there was frustration around the top table and throughout the entire school, actually, of the fact that performance management was still based on database targets, on metrics, and development was almost sidelined as part of performance management, which we thought, well, what's the point of trying to performance manage someone if you're not actually to try to make them better? You know, you can't always fluke good results, but one year you could get good results because you just get good results. So if we work on development, that will make a huge difference. Another thing that we really realized was we had a massive wealth of knowledge within our staff. You know, they were a very academic staff body, but we didn't treat them like academics, which was huge. So one of our mantras very early was about, you know, our staff are academics, we'll treat you like academics, and we'll give you the freedom to behave in that way and take on knowledge and pedagogy in that way. And we really wanted to foster that culture of continuous improvement and not change. And that was one of the big moments for our school, where we started to use the word improvement and not change a lot more. And I know Vivian Robinson's done some excellent work on this recently. And I think both of us were in one of their presentations recently where she spoke about this. And it was one of the ideas that we picked up as a leadership team, that we've got to avoid using the word change. And I'm not saying I'm perfect on it, but we do try as a team to talk about improvement rather than change. What that needed us to become was like a really self-aware school. So we needed to become aware of where we were as a school and not pull any punches with that. And I'm guessing it's a really hard thing to do for a lot of schools out there. For us, it was incredibly tough because we were so personally attached to the school. So myself, like I was saying, I've been there as a student. The head, you know, he drives across the country to get there every weekend. You know, he goes up and down from Yorkshire to Northamptonshire because that's where he lives. He lives up in Yorkshire. Then the rest of the leadership team had long ties to the school. Like, they've been teaching there 10 years, or some of them were students there as well, like myself. Some of them had been a TA there and grown throughout the school from like a TA to a teacher to head of year to like leadership team. And we really needed to get our head around what was happening within our school. And essentially it came down to two things. We need to know our kids and what were the gaps with our kids. We really needed to get to know our staff. And then if we had a good picture of what was going on with those two things, we could start to build something that could lead in a direction with staff to make a difference. Now, I know you asked about how this sort of like went to an action research project. Don't worry, I haven't gone off track here. This was the start of that journey. Yeah. So essentially, if we have the idea of where our kids are at and where our staff are at, and therefore we know our school, we can get to a point about what we need to do next. So information about kids, really straightforward. We had good assessment processes at that point. We really knew what our kids knew and what they didn't know. We knew about what were our areas of underperformance in the school. That was all within our AVP, really clear. When it came to staff, though, you know, we knew we had a staff that enjoyed working with us, that we had buy-in from them for all the stuff we were talking about. But did we actually know them? Did we actually know what they liked? What were their pedagogical interests? What motivates them? What makes them tick? And we didn't know any of it, if we were brutally honest. We knew the people we line managed, but did we know their teams? Not at all. We didn't know what certain people had done that were new to the school. You know, yes, we'd read their CVs, but actually we dug behind that, probably within the recruitment process, but was that more than two or three people in the school that knew that? Well, no. And that was a real problem for us when we thought, if we're going to adopt this model of growing from within, and if we're going to try to improve the school, we need to know our staff. So we implemented a strategy called career stage interviews, where every member of staff, top to bottom, from the head all the way down to cleaners within the school, to every single person you can think of within a school, got an hour-long meeting with a member of SLT. Outside of line management, outside of performance management. And it was all about the staff. It was an hour chat about the staff. And it was a series of questions that we asked about what motivates them, what their greatest achievements were of the year. Essentially, WWWs and EBIs of the school. We tried to keep it the same three people over, same two people over a three-year process, so they got to know each other. And it was all about how the school could support the staff's aim over the next 1, 3, 5 years. It was a massive thing for us, a massive undertaking. We're actually going through that process right now. So as a member of leadership, we're probably seeing between 14 and 20 people each for these sessions. And although it's a massive investment of time, the information we gain from it is huge, because it completely shifts the culture. It got us to really know our staff, and it got us to understand whether our staff knew what we wanted from them as well. So, you know, we were talking about high levels of subject knowledge at that point, and the six effective learning strategies that learning scientists talk about, and high expectations. And if our staff weren't aware of these things, then are we doing our job right as leadership? So we know our staff now from the career stage interviews. We know our kids, therefore, in theory, we should know our school. So when you've got the school's needs and the staff's needs, and you've got the middle like an Venn diagram, you've got this sweet spot in the middle where they overlap. And that's where you find your golden thread. That's where you find what your CPD focus has got to be for the next year. Because you know what your staff are interested in, you know what your staff know and what they don't know, you know what your kids are good at, you know what they know and what they don't know, and you've got that gap in the middle that you need to put a railroad through. And that led us to come up with our CPD themes for the year. And it's through that that we almost invested into this action research project. So we'd have a theme, say something like cognitively active learning, or feedback, or something like that.
So it would be some kind of direction for teachers from SLT, but within that they could choose an area that they wanted to focus on.
You know? Exactly. So, sorry?
Similar to what we did at Beverley High School, I'm thinking.
Yeah, so we have this like overarching theme, but within that, you could break it down however you wish. So when we're talking about cognitive active learning, one of the things that people could be looking at is something like warm strategies to engage students in the classroom, if that's the issues that they're having in their classes. If the issues that other people are having are to do with adaptive teaching, they'd look more down that route. And we essentially produced a menu of ideas. So only four or five to say, if you want to look into things, these are the things to look into. And that was the birth, essentially, of the Action Research Project. And it's all the groundwork that's before the Action Research Project that I think is so important. You could just say, cool, yeah, let's just do this project, go and do a bit of research. But if it doesn't have almost like a setup behind it, like putting in places each of those Lego bricks, then actually it's not going to lead to what you want it to do, which is actually be outcome driven. You want it to have an influence on the school, a difference, and make a difference to the school, possibly have a huge part to play in the ADP for the next year. So you want something to come out of these projects that's going to affect the school going forward. And the only way you do that is by putting in all the effort beforehand.
Yeah, I think giving teachers autonomy of form development is really important, but I agree that it has to be within a direction that's agreed by the school. So I'm just thinking then, so if you are a teacher at Wren, what does an action research project look like? What is the process that you would have to go through if you were a teacher at Wren?
So we launch these at the start of every year. So one of our, I've just been writing the calendar for next year, actually. And one of the things that we do is we put in Thursday CPD sessions, and one of the, as part of directed time. And one of the sessions that we have very early in the year is the launch of the Action Research Project. And what we really push in the school is the culture behind it, which is that it's, you know, us as leaders, yes, we might be setting the tempo, but actually all of us in the school are writing the music, essentially. So this is what's going to be making a difference to our school going forward. So in the first instance, within the classroom, staff are aware that this Action Research Project has to be a big part of what they're doing with the classroom. You know, it is one of the performance development targets. It's essentially the biggest, the most important performance development target, because if they get this right, they're improving as a teacher, and they'll feel the satisfaction of that. So what they actually do within the classroom is take like an area of pedagogy and or of practice or of something that they know they need to improve on. So they might need to feel they need to do more on, say, dual coding or on adaptive teaching or improve their subject knowledge because they're weak in a certain area. So they'll go away, they'll do a bit of work on that. And what we push for isn't just quantitative data. We don't want people to say, oh, we got this percentage at this point and this percentage at that point. That's great, okay, but it can't tell you everything. So what we look for is a lot of qualitative stuff in this. So we want students to be able to know more and then do more. So tied in with this is the idea of how we do observations. So we like to get staff into small, and this is something we've only tried recently, and it's starting to grow. And it was interesting when we pushed this idea forward, because a lot of staff were like, really, is that the next step? Are we going that light touch as a leadership team, almost, was the thought process behind it. So we as leadership don't do observations anymore in the school at all. You know, we go in, we wander around, we support, we make sure that the tone for behavior is right, make sure the tone for attitude towards learning is right from students, but we're not going to go in and do, you know, sit there with a piece of paper and an Ofsted grade student and staff or anything like that. That's not what we do. But what we do encourage is that staff buddy up in threes, twos or threes, fours, then go see each other. And then they talk about their practice afterwards, and they talk about their action research projects and how they're actually making a difference within the classroom, or when they can see differences over a period of time. So if they came in September and taught X, Y, Z, and then if they came in November and then taught X, Y, and Z, they'll say, I can see how that shifted from there to there. So we're looking heavily at that qualitative stuff as well. Staff then take that information and do like a write-up at the end of the year, and they submit it to us, which we publish in a booklet. So every year we have a booklet of action research projects that we hand out to staff, and at a celebration event at the end of each year in July. And we were really lucky last year to have the Chartered College there with us. And it was a phenomenal event, and we get a few people presenting their projects. You know, we ask, is anyone interested, or has anyone felt they've really hit on something that could affect next year's ADP? And, you know, when we're reading them, we think, oh, I can see how that one can affect it. So even small things like the language we used in reporting changed this year based off one of the action research projects from last year from one of our NQTs. So little things like that made it really clear to our staff that actually it doesn't matter where you are in your career, what stage you're at, but if you've got something to say, you can show how it's making a difference, we'll take that on board. So when these trios go into each other, they feed back to the member of staff, and the member of staff writes up their own observation report. So no leader essentially writes up an observation report for teachers within the school. It's all done independently by the member of staff, or reflectively, I should say, I guess. And then they're quality assured by the curriculum leaders in those areas. And if there's any sort of areas where things need ironing out a bit, then they can talk about it and we can move forward from there. But that process of writing up the presentation and that process of that trio observations quality assured by the curriculum leaders is our way of monitoring the action research projects and how they grow. So staff have the freedom to investigate within the themes that we set, but they don't feel they have to produce like a 24-page paper with graphs and tables. That's not what it's about. Yeah, you know, that's what happens in the lab. What happens in the classroom is very different. And what we're looking at is, can we get kids to know more and do more? And yes, if there's an impact that we can see in data, great. But mainly, how is what is happening in the classroom changing? Because that's where the improvements are going to happen. If we can improve what happens in the classroom, things will get better. And that's our sustainable approach to it.
Yeah, what I really like about the idea of the trios, and actually any kind of culture like the action research culture, where you're giving staff the chance to have these professional conversations, you're facilitating a dialogue that seemed to be missing before. And that's the thing that I found from Berkeley High School, but also in the trust, that actually one of the priorities that we've had is how can we facilitate these professional conversations? Because I think it's so important, talking to, you know, a PE teacher talking to a maths teacher about pedagogy is so powerful. I think we can learn a lot from our colleagues. And it was when we had this kind of standalone CPD focus that was just missing. So how many years has the action research model been in place at Wren?
So this is our third year of the model. And if I'm honest, in the first year, we thought we really got it right. Like, it made a massive difference to what was going on. We let it loose a bit in the second year. And that's where we realized that if things aren't linked necessarily directly to an outcome, or the outcomes that we're expecting of the school or to the ADP, that you don't get that tightness. So we had to adjust it in year to get it to what we wanted it to be. And this is our third year of it. We obviously, because of COVID, have had to put a pause to it, which is a real shame. But what we have done to almost replace it is look at the absolute mass of online CPD there is, and give people a real direction in terms of look down this route, look down this route, think about this. That tie in with what we've got. So, you know, events like Research Ed Loom, so the Research Ed Durrington, which was all online, that was great because there were certain areas of that tied in with our ADP for what we're looking at next, like standard of explanations and subject knowledge, and all those sort of ideas were coming up. So we could really sort of direct videos to people and say, if you're logging on Saturday, this is the one to watch.
Yeah, I think there's a whole different conversation to be had around CPD post-COVID. Interesting times.
Yes, definitely.
So actually 3 years is probably enough time just to kind of get your teeth into it, but maybe not enough time to be able to see impact. But I'm going to ask you this anyway.
Oh, I don't
what has been the impact so far?
So if anyone's come to see myself and Dawn speak, Dawn Ashbolt, who normally presents with me when we talk about our journey at Wren, the impact data is really, really clear to see there. I mean, the first year that we did action research projects, there was a massive swing in our data of about 0.5 on progress rate. So we went from negative 0.35 to positive 0.2 within a year. And we can't put it all on action research. We can't say, oh, action research was the thing that swung it massively. But what we can say is it was one of the key driving factors. It did improve the quality teaching learning. So in terms of outcome data, there's that, but there's other data as well. So retention of staff is through the roof. I mean, I think 2 years ago, we lost one member of staff for promotion and that was it. Last year, I think again, it was only one or two members of staff, one for promotion, one for relocation, I want to say. And this year, I think there's only two going at the end of the year, one for relocation. And I think the other one's for promotion as well. So what it's built is is not only improvement in data, in terms of hard data as in like progress aid, but also improvements in terms of staff well-being and actually them feeling like they're valued by their leadership team. Now I'm not going to sit here and say that we've got this completely right, because I did mention there was a year where it got a bit wobbly, and that was last year where our outcomes did dip. We dipped to about 0.04 on progress aid, but still above zero. We can't say, well, it was because of action research that not being right that happened. But one of the things we can say is that we possibly weren't as tight on certain things as we were the year before. So it's about finding that spot. But then, as we know, outcomes are always volatile. They go all over the place and they do move up and down. As much as I'm the lead for data, I know that data doesn't always tell the entire story behind what's taking place. Hard numbers tell you certain things, but they don't tell you the full story for sure.
No, you don't know what the data would have been were it not for the action research.
Oh, it would have been amazing. It would have been amazing if there was no COVID this year. We would have been through the roof, absolutely. Top 10%, definitely.
Everyone else. I think actually HR data is really important to consider. If you've got low staff turnover, you are developing your teachers, but also you're keeping them. And I think that's really important. We kind of found the same thing at Beverley High School, that kind of the hard data, the outcome data, was improving. Could we say that was because we had implemented a new CPD program? Who knows? But the kind of the softer anecdotal data that was coming up, conversations that we were having with staff, was that they felt happier, they enjoyed the autonomy, they were enjoying the job more, they felt more relaxed.
And that autonomy versus direction thing is a really difficult balance to hit, isn't it? It's like you want to give them the freedom to go after what they enjoy, but they need to be directed so they feel like they're making a difference. And I think there's a real seesaw there between those two things.
And we had a similar situation to you at Beverley High School, where we'd had an Ofsted inspection. We were an outstanding school and we were told we required improvement, and that was a real blow. That was a real blow, and all the things that you were saying about, you know, tears, and, you know, it's kind of like shell shock, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
That's where we were coming from. We were kind of coming out of that. We have a battered and bruised teaching staff. And allowing them to go and start to take more control of their own development after such a rough ride of really focused direction. Because as you know, when you're trying to jump through those hoops, you have to take kind of quite clear direction from your SLT. It felt like the right time to do it. And it was nice to see the softer impact on staff well-being too.
Yeah, I think it's crucial that those sort of things are kept an eye on. I said it earlier on that, you know, no member of staff wakes up to do a bad job. So things aren't going right. I think it's the job of leaders to really unpick it and see what is not going right to make a difference there.
Okay, so give me some examples then of some of the themes that teachers choose and,
So some of the things that they've done recently, there was one recently on Cornell note taking. So we've done a lot on the effective learning strategies, and someone thought, well, there's a real clear link here between the work in the 6 effective learning strategies that learning scientists have come up with and the whole way in which Cornell notes are processed. So they tried to make a link between those two things, which is a great presentation. And some people taking leadership ideas from outside of education. So people like Matthew Saeed's book, and looking at the whole idea of performance, and tying that in with their leadership styles, which is phenomenal. It was a really, really good presentation we had on that. Some people have looked into Dweck's growth mindsets to see how that can affect some of the language that we use in classrooms. So there's been a wide variety of things that have been looked at. One of some of the most interesting ones have been based around things that have come off the EEF. So when feedback was our theme a couple of years ago, people really dug into the EEF and started to have a look at what they could find on there to help them with their thinking behind what could make a difference in the classroom. So, you know, they read books like Simplicity of Rules and looked at ideas to do with like whole class feedback in there and how that can make a difference. And what we found is when all these things happen, they start to affect what we're doing as practice across the whole school. So marking was still something that happened at Wren 3-ish years ago. And when people started looking into feedback, and actually feedback being the key for improvement and lowering workload, you know, we came up with this idea of fab books, where actually only the assessed work would go into this book, and looking more at feedback. And we started to adapt more and more strategies based around that, moving towards a whole class feedback model, where actually we're just giving feedback to entire class, working closely with 2 or 3 pupils that we know are struggling, and then moving them forward at the rate of knots that they need to move along at, while the rest of the class can get that generic feedback because they're pretty much on track. So in terms of the sort of themes that we look at, feedback, cognitive active learning, the bigger themes, loads of them have been related to that, but people have realized that there's links between what we're doing year on year. And you can think about teaching in like isolated silos, but it's not a great way to think about pedagogy. When we're thinking about pedagogy, everything links. Every action we take in the classroom must be linked to something. So if they've done something like Cornell note taking, that will link to some, it will link to feedback. If, you know, if you're doing Cornell note taking a certain way and you've done it based around the six effective learning strategies, well, it'll probably improve how you give your feedback because the way things are laid out. So a wide variety of things, but everything is linked. And we encourage the idea that try to link things to either something you've done before or something that someone did last year that you read that you quite liked.
Yeah, when you're talking about that, it's making me think about kind of when you first start to look at evidence in education and the things that you want, you might want to look at, just how difficult it is to pin down the one thing that you're going to focus on. So if you're going to do action research or an inquiry like the model that we developed at Beverley High School, that actually, how do you pick that one thing? Because there's so many things.
It's really tough. It is really tough to pick that one thing. And I think staff really struggle with that, which is why I think the direction is key. Because if you're saying, well, try to keep it within here, and remember we did this last year, then actually they've got sort of an area to play within. It's almost like you give them a sandbox and say, yeah, just play in this sandbox. You know, you can branch off to that one and that one, but stay within this one pretty much. And I think that makes a real big difference to staff when they know where you want them to be. I mean, there's always this feeling in staff that actually, yes, we want direction. And again, it comes back to that autonomy versus direction thing, where yes, we want direction, but where we really empower staff is by giving the autonomy to play within it. So it's almost like providing a framework and work within that framework almost. And yeah. I think that's where our staff had the most enjoyment from action research, working in that way, definitely.
And then when you start to have, again, those professional conversations, and then you've got, you know, one teacher talking about something they've done, Cornell note-taking, for example, and maybe another teacher hasn't heard of that, and they have those conversations, and it might lead to potentially a different route for the next year. Yeah, it's really exciting, isn't it?
It is, and this is why we publish what we do every year, so that staff can read it, and we leave it in the staff room. So we're a split site school. We have two staff rooms. We have a stack of these left in the staff room. One gets posted in every... We still have pigeonholes. It's one of those type of schools. Still got pigeonholes. So we put one in every staff member's pigeonhole, and they all get to keep one. But we have a stack that any visitor who comes to the school can have a read and have a look at. And they're all in the same sort of like format throughout it, the form that they're filled in, the single double-sided sheets. And if anyone wants to put an appendices in there, they can. But it's a really lovely thing when you can bring someone an interview or a skit student into the staff room and say, have a look at this. This is the work that we've done. I mean, last year, this is one of the things that I'm really passionate about in terms of harnessing the talents of your staff. Last year, I spoke to one of the art teachers that at my school and said, would you be willing to do one of those live drawings of the staff as they're giving the action research presentations? If I gave you the names of who was doing it beforehand, so you could have the pictures on there, and then you could sort of write keywords in pencil and do a bit of work afterwards. In terms of making it look really nice, are you willing to do that? And I posted the picture, I think, yesterday, because today is exactly a year ago from when it happened, from when we had those presentations. So that picture's there, and that was a member of our staff that did that, and it was such a proud moment for everyone at the school. They all gathered around to see the work that she was doing, and it's just amazing to see what happens when you start to harness the talent of the staff that you have, and they see what staff can actually do. And making it a special moment is so important when people present their action research projects, because they put a year's worth of work into it, essentially, and actually it is a big deal of work, and it's a really important thing for them, definitely.
Yeah, I think having that celebration at the end is really important, and actually something that we kind of tried to get across both at Beverley High School and at Teal was that if you try something out and it doesn't work, that is equally as valid as trying something out and seeing a positive impact. And it's just the work that's gone into it that is the thing to be celebrated. Okay, so last question. Can you tell me your funniest or most embarrassing teacher story? We've all got one, Nim.
Oh, God. Yeah. there's a few of these. I don't think I can say all of them publicly. Sorry, what was that, Jo?
It can't be the one you told me yesterday.
Oh, yeah, you know, it won't be that one, no. There's other, so you just want to know everything about me, okay. Right, so back in 2009, it's when I met my wife and I was about to get married, and so her name's Pooja, and there was someone who I was working closely with at another school, because we were setting up a project, And the person on the other, who I was talking to almost like every week, was also a computer. And it was a lot of late nights during that time because of just wedding planning and things like that. And I don't know if you know much about Indian weddings, but they're like 4 days long. So yeah, a lot of planning taking place then. So I always end the phone call to my wife at that time because we were still, she was in Northampton or up in Leicester at the time, and I was obviously still working and living with my parents at the time in Wellingborough. God, that makes me sound so bad. I was living with my parents at the age of 25. Oh gosh, there you go. The world can know that one. I'd always end a phone call, love you, bye. And so because this other person was called Pooja, I don't know why in my head I ended the phone call with her, love you, bye. And then I was about to hang up. I was like, oh my God, I've just said this to the wrong person. So I spent the next 15 minutes possibly apologizing. But I have a history of things like this. Because when I came back to Wren in about 2015, 2016-ish, we were planning a trip to CERN, and one of the things that I had to do there was work with this person in one of our other local schools, and her name was Abby, as in ABBY, not the IE version. And at that point was the first time I really started to use emails on my phone a lot more. I tried to avoid doing it purely because I know it just leads to typos, and if anyone's following me on Twitter, they'll know that I'm just the king of typos. I have typos everywhere. But when I typed in "Hi Abby" into a message in my first real introduction to her, because we were about to plan a trip to CERN together, when I typed in "Hi Abby," it auto-corrected "Abby" to "Baby," and I didn't check. And I sent the entire email. So the email said "Hi Baby," and then was then talking about going to CERN. So yeah, that was great fun. That was great fun.
That was amazing. I bet you thought you were right.
Yeah, there's other things like teaching with sunglasses on. I had to do for about a good 6 months on and off after I paper cut my eye. So yeah, there's a story behind that. Yeah, wow. So a paper. I'm just an absolute klutz when it comes to so many things. So I paper cut my eye when I was picking up some of the old science tests that used to have like an insert of a equation sheet within there. So as they were like above my eye level. So I was pulling them down, and the box was quite an old box. As I pulled it, the box ripped and all the papers fell down on me. So I put my head down, all the papers fell over my head, and I looked up, and the sheet, I could literally just see it floating down. I did not react quick enough at all, and it just cut straight across my eye. So I paper cut my eye, and over a period of every 6 months from then on, it was almost like it would scab up, and then the scab would fall out when I'd wake up in the morning. But not just like fall out of my eye, but I could feel it almost like peel off. When I open my, I'm guessing I'm going to make you throw up, so I'll carry on, Joe, don't worry. Every time I open my eye in the morning, I could, well, not every time, but once every 6 months-ish, I could almost like feel it peel off. And I knew I was going to have one of those days at that point where I was really sensitive to light. So I had to wear sunglasses those days while teaching. One of the days it happened was during one of the modular science exams, and I was due to be in at like 7 o'clock for a breakfast club revision for that science exam that day. So I came in at 7 o'clock, about 60 kids throughout that morning poured into the room, and they all just looked at me saying, why sir wearing sunglasses? And essentially that's where I learned warm strict, and I was very clear with them about my expectation about not talking about the sunglasses. So yeah, a whole raft of embarrassing stories,
and put me off my dinner, so thanks a lot.
That's not a problem, that's my job, talking about food, that's what we do.
Parmesan shavings and never look the same again.
Oh gosh, you can never have enough cheese, Joe. You know this, you can never have enough cheese.
Well, it's been lovely chatting to you, Neil. Is there anywhere that if any of the listeners wanted to find out a bit more about Action Research that they could go to have a look?
Yes, so on my Twitter handle at nlad84, there's a link to my blog, and the research ed presentation that we've spoken about today is actually available on there. I know that you've done loads of work on it yourself as well, Joe, so I'm sure that you'd be happy to talk to people about Action Research and those sort of models as well. So yeah, just feel free to get in touch on Twitter or have a look at the presentation on the blog, but yeah, just get in touch.
Lovely, thank you very much, the man, the legend, Nimlad.
Thank you very much, Joe, thank you very much.
So moving into the podcast pedagogy section, and some kids I taught and what they taught me is the 2020 Orwell Prize winning memoir by Kate Clanchy. So Kate is a writer, teacher and a journalist. And in this book, Kate discusses how she wants to change the world and how she thinks that school is an excellent place to do this. So in this memoir, Kate invites us, the listener, to meet some of the kids that she has taught in her 30-year career. And there are some real insights in this book. I particularly enjoyed reading about Kate working within the school's inclusion unit and how she nurtured her multicultural poetry group, watching them find their voice and produce some breathtaking work. Kate doesn't glamorise teaching, and she describes in detail painful episodes in her career, but she does celebrate this most creative, passionate and practically useful of jobs. So teaching, as we know, isn't always easy, particularly in 2020, and it isn't always valued as maybe it should be by wider society. But some kids I taught and what they taught me will show you why it absolutely should be. So Some Kids I Taught and What They Taught Me is available at your local bookstore or everywhere now. So next week on Nailers Natter, we have my interview with Joe Nutt. So look forward to that on next week's episode. So it remains for me to say thank you as always for listening and see you next week.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Podcast pedagogy. What is Phil reading this week? Podcast pedagogy. Listening to teachers.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.